Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit and earned a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Marquette University. He's the chairman of Wallbridge, which is an international construction firm specializing in the design, build, and management of large-scale projects for automotive and mega data centers. And from 2019 to 2020, he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, and as such was the first political ambassador to the UAE. His name, John Ricolta Jr. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to the chairman of Wallbridge, John Ricolta Jr. John, welcome. We had you on many years ago. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I am delighted to be back in the greater Detroit area. And this is a wonderful winter day that you and I are speaking. Temperature about 60, 70 degrees lower than what I was experiencing last year at this time. But I have to tell you, I couldn't be better suited to be here, and I'm delighted to be home.
All right. Speaking of being home, your dad worked for Wallbridge, your grandfather worked for Wallbridge, and you started your first job at Wallbridge at age 12. What did they have you do?
Well, the first thing my dad and my grandfather tried to teach me is work ethic. We come from Eastern Europe. Romania is a fact, and we're very proud of that. And that country has an incredible work ethic all the way down to the everyday man, which I was and I am today. And nothing gives me greater pleasure than to work hard. I get a lot of satisfaction and joy out of it, notwithstanding, obviously, the material remunerations that come along with that. But that was the first thing. And the second thing was to get me out of my mother's hair. I was a rambunctious 12-year-old kid. And my dad wanted to introduce me to the family business, wanted me to see what kind of potential there possibly was there, and tried to encourage me and excite me. So for the first year, I cut the grass, painted 2x4s, pulled nails out of scrap lumber, and was under the watchful eye of my grandfather.
George Wallbridge and Albert Eldinger started a business in March of 1916, which now is known as Wallbridge. What does it do?
Well, we are an international construction, engineering, facilities management company that also has quite a portfolio in real estate development. And we specialize in doing work for big corporate Fortune 50 companies like Ford and General Motors and Toyota, Microsoft, Amazon Web Services, and the list goes on. And we build our facilities for them, where they make cars, where they design cars, where they store data, and where Amazon ships goods out of their various warehouses around the country.
You got a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Marquette, and I believe you started at Wallbridge in 1970. John, paint for us a picture of what the company was like 50-plus years ago.
We were a good automotive contractor. We were doing $50 million worth of volume a year, had maybe 150 employees. My dad owned a whole ball of wax, if you will. And I graduated with a civil engineering degree with the intention of coming home and ultimately taking over the firm from my dad. We did most of our work here in the greater Detroit area, probably 80% of it. But over the course of the history of the company, had developed a reputation of traveling to other lands like Canada, other states like Ohio and Indiana to do specific jobs. And so that was the state of affairs when I entered in, actually was August of 1970.
Your dad was legendary, your late dad. What's the biggest thing he taught you about business?
My dad first had two rules. Number one, cash is king. And any decent man would pay off his home mortgage as soon as he possibly could. so that he could never worry about him losing his home in some economic collapse. So that was the first thing, cash is king. And the second thing was that there is nothing that replaces hard work, that you don't have to be the brightest bulb in the pack. If you worked hard, treated people well, and always served your customers, you could be successful in life. And he gave me my chance at a very early age.
All right. 1979, you became the president of Walbridge. And then in 93, you became its CEO chairman. So you had a 49-year career. Then you took a hiatus, which we'll talk about later. But let's talk about that 49-year chapter of your life. Tell us the highlights and the struggles and what you learned, if you will.
The highlight was working with my dad. Our offices were next door to each other. I often tell the story to up-and-comers today that my dad and I had lunch, breakfast, or dinner together over that 30-year period of time of almost 3,000 times. And when I look around the world today, I don't see any relationships between father and son reaching that kind of both intensity and closeness. Number two, my father allowed me all the rope that I wanted to get in terms of risk-taking, and he really taught me how to evaluate risk. And his first question always was, well, how much is this going to cost? And from that, we would then get into discussions, debates, intellectual tension about what the best approach was after we knew what the cost of something was and what our return was going to be. And then the final thing, and I think he learned this from the guy he took the company over with, and it almost goes back to 1916, and that is, we were really a company that was owned by its stakeholders as opposed to its shareholders. They called that ESG today. But back then in the 70s and 80s, we had six stakeholder groups that we thought really were the essence of the company. Certainly the shareholders were one of them, but it was almost like an inverted pyramid. They were at the bottom of the pack, and you had to treat your team members or your employees very, very well. Your customer was number one. Your suppliers and subcontractors had to have the utmost trust, confidence, and faith with you. The environment was important, and we couldn't abuse it. And then finally, we owed a debt to the community at large and have always been community-minded in terms of both our personal lives and our corporate lives. So when you add all that up together, he was a visionary that began to show us, you know, how do you build a company on a solid foundation?
Speaking of community, as long as I've known you, you bleed Michigan. You love the people of Michigan, and you love the kids of Detroit. Why so much love for them?
Well, let me put it more succinctly. I love Detroit, and Michigan comes along for the ride. And the reason I love Detroit is it's where I was born. It's where I went to public school, Detroit Public Schools. It's where I lived for the first 16 years of my life. And so it's home. And I don't think you can ever turn your back on home. I think there's something genetic about your makeup that makes home so important to you. It's a place that you're comfortable with. It's the place that you were raised. It's the place that gave you your start. So that's for starters. Now, when it comes to the kids themselves, you know, I think the Detroit kids have gotten a raw deal. And the school system was broken. To a large degree, it's had some repair, but it still isn't functioning as well as it should. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you don't have a chance in life unless you have a top-notch education. There was a statistic that came out of the Obama years that said over his presidency, there was 11 million jobs that were created. All but a handful of them, less than 100,000, went to kids and people who had college degrees, associate degrees, technical school degrees. If you didn't have a degree of some shape or form in vocational school and trade school all counted, you went nowhere. And in order to get into any of those programs today, you have to know how to read, write, do all kind of math skills. And so if we want to have a fair and balanced society and opportunity for all, these kids have to be educated exactly to the degree and to the skill level as the suburban kids are. And I didn't see that happening. It's my home. I felt compelled to get involved.
We're talking to John Rakolta, who was one of the national finance chairs for Mitt Romney's 2008 2012 presidential campaigns. When we come back, we're going to ask him about this. And I'm Jack Rasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasool. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to John Rakolta, and in 2018, he was named Michiganian of the Year by the Detroit News. John, 2008, 2012, he helped raise a lot of money for Mitt Romney in his presidential campaigns. What did you learn in that endeavor?
I learned that politics is a blood sport and that you have to have a really, really thick skin in order to participate. That's number one. Number two, I learned that the truth doesn't always come out, that our society today has become so polarized that we're willing to win at any cost, where the means justifies the end. And then the third thing I realized is how important money is to a campaign, that without sufficient resources, you can't get your message out. And so we didn't win in 2008 or in 2012, to speak of, but I gained a tremendous amount of experience on how politics really work and the role that I wanted to play going forward.
Okay, let's go to 2016. You get a call from Donald Trump, and I'm going to run for president, John, and I'm going to win, and I need your help. That was your first one-on-one with him. You've had a series of them, one-on-ones. What's the man like?
Well, I think there's two Donald Trumps. There's the Donald Trump that I met, the Donald Trump that asked me to serve as ambassador, the Donald Trump that supported my mission in the UAE, and I couldn't give him higher marks than what he was able to do for me. He supported me. We had debates about the direction that we were going to go in. He was one of the best listeners that I've ever come across, asked provocative, penetrating questions, and actually listens to advice. I was very, very surprised by all of that, and I think as a result of that, we were able to accomplish a lot in terms of the more than, I guess, 3 years that I had known I was going to become the ambassador, and then 18 months that I was the ambassador. And he was a terrific boss. You know, as far as everything else is concerned, you know, every person will have to judge him accordingly, both his public and his private persona. But his private persona with me was A+.
I quote you now, Jack, I spent 800 days in purgatory from the time he first said, would you like to be ambassador, to the day the Senate voted on you. 2.2 years. Mr. Rakolta, why so long?
Well, the process that our government has to get a confirmation by the Senate requires 14 distinct steps. A couple of them are all of the background checks that they do to make sure that there isn't something in your closet that would prevent you from representing the United States in the highest manner. Then there's the security clearance that you need to undergo, and that's even more intrusive and intensive to make sure that you'll keep the secrets of our country forever. And then you've got to go to the foreign government that you're going to and ask for their permission. And then once all that's done, and that usually takes 6 to 8 months, you then start to go through the process of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And as you can see, even today, that's a process that's fraught with political intrigue, horse trading, and settling political scores, notwithstanding all of the research that they do to make sure that everything that the administration reported about you is true. And we got stuck, myself and others, in this battle royale that went on between the Democrats and the Republicans, not allowing very many ambassadors go out to post. And unfortunately, President Biden today is suffering from that also. Last I read, there was 50 posts around the world that did not have an ambassador.
All right. You were the first political ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, and you were actually confirmed by the Senate on September 17th, 2019, 63-30. So you get over, you and Terry get over to the United Arab Emirates. Tell us about that country, that partner.
Well, they had been a tier one strategic partner of the United States for a very long period of time. We enjoy a large trade surplus with them, over $20 billion a year. They are totally aligned with us in terms of our foreign policy, and our military excursions have supported us in Afghanistan, Syria, and other countries, and love the United States of America. Many, if not most, of their top officials have been educated in the United States. They speak perfect English. They are a society that is striving and reaching toward modernity today, and really want to continue to be United States' best friend. However, there were some stress points when I got out there. One of them was the Muslim Brotherhood and the differencing opinion as to what the Muslim Brotherhood actually stood for. Was it a political organization? Was it a terrorism organization? And then there was the JCPOA, which is the Iran nuclear deal that they were 100% against. And those two issues started to drive some cracks in our otherwise excellent relationship. So I basically termed the fact that we were had a stagnant relationship with them. And then you can lay on top of that Expo, which is the World's Fair that the United States was not going to participate in for funding reasons. Congress had determined that they weren't going to fund the State Department's efforts, and business no longer wanted to either. And so it was about my job to tell the Emiratis that we weren't going to show up. And that would have been equivalent of the United States not showing up for one of the Olympic Games. It was a warm welcome. They wanted a political ambassador, which has closer ties to the administration than career ambassadors too. And so I spent the first 60 days going around and meeting with all 30 of their top cabinet officials to get a good sense of where our relationship stood, and had a very good understanding before I came back in Christmas of 2019 to report to the National Security Council just exactly where we were.
All right. When we were together a few weeks ago, you showed me a picture of Dubai in 1971. It was the largest sandbox in the world. There was nothing. 50 years later, the architecture is stunning. Anybody that's seen pictures of any one building, they're amazed. How did it happen?
Well, as it turned out, the one emirate called Abu Dhabi had enormous oil reserves that were just beginning to get discovered. And along with their march toward tolerance and modernity, they developed an incredible knack of what to do with this enormous wealth that they had. And they started to attract many, many foreign expats to come and live in their country. They got many individuals and corporations to invest in their country. And the combination of talent and capital and their own capital, they were able to build basically a new society over the last 50 years that's just incredible. And that picture that you saw is good for both Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And it really shows the progress that they have made in a short 50 years.
Talking to John Ricolta, who was our ambassador to United Arab Emirates from 2019 to 2020. And as such, he had a staff of 1,400. When we come back, we're going to ask him, what does an ambassador do each day? And I'm Jack Kertzula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with John Ricolta Jr. And from 2019 to 2020, he was U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates and was the first political ambassador ever to the UAE. He had a staff of 1,400 people. What does a U.S. ambassador, John, do every day?
Well, let's start out with the fact that you are the personal representative of both the United States of America and the President of the United States. And there are certain responsibilities and authorities that are given to you by law. Back in the olden days, an ambassador could actually declare war on behalf of the country. Now, of course, communications has made that virtually something that is no longer needed. And now, obviously, something that I would never have considered. But just to go to show you the enormous responsibility and authority that you have. So what your responsibilities are, quite simple. Protect the United States of America, both its borders and its people that are sitting in your country. Number two, to drive prosperity through peace. And the final thing is to represent our country through what they call representation. That is the policy part, which is the three P's that I talk about. There's also the administrative part of running an embassy with 1,400 people. There are all the normal issues that crop up in any kind of a working environment. Every single State Department employee gets rotated out every 3 years. So we're constantly moving people back and forth to keep the embassy fresh and vibrant. So I sort of relegated the a day-to-day operational aspect of the embassy to my number two man. It was called the DCM, the Deputy Chief of Mission. I was the Chief of Mission, and he would come to me with reports and data, issues, things that they wanted me to do. And so he was more or less the Chief Operating Officer. I was the Chief Executive Officer, and we had 30 agencies there in country, Commerce, Treasury, Homeland Security, FBI, and the list goes on and on and on. And my responsibility was to coordinate the activities of all of these agencies, make sure that they're comporting with the policy set forth by the President of the United States, and to get the Emiratis to get ever closer to us as a country. And that was a full-time job that required a lot of meetings, a lot of public press conferences and public speeches, television shows that I went on, and also engaging with the Emirati public at large. And so that's what an ambassador does. And the day is filled from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to sleep. It was probably the most exciting 600 days that I've ever had in my entire life, working 18 hours a day. And you'll have to remember that Abu Dhabi was 9 hours ahead of Washington. And so no sooner than Washington would wake up and our day would end, you'd start all over again and you'd go till you dropped and then get 6-7 hours of sleep and start all over again. And guess what? I never felt tired, never felt worn out. As I said just a little bit ago, it was the most exhilarating period of time that I've ever had.
We're talking to John Ricolta Jr. If you want to learn more about him, www.wallbridge.com. With one L, WALBRIDGE.com. All right. You were an employee of the State Department under the Trump administration. And as such, you reported up to the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Tell us about Michael Pompeo, please.
He's a terrific leader. I had many occasions to interface directly with him. He's much like myself. He was direct. He was frank. There was no BS involved, not a lot of storytelling. Let's get to the point. I'm sure he was a very, very busy guy. And no matter what issue that I had, that if I eventually had to go to him, he was available, made himself available, came to the UAE twice. The ambassador is privileged to have the number one seat next to any principal that comes into country. So all the meetings that he would have with the leadership, I would be sitting right there, and he represented our country in the best manner that I could possibly explain and say.
All right. Speaking of our country, what did you learn about our country, the United States of America, in those 600 days that you were in the UAE as our ambassador?
Well, let me tell you two touch points. One is all the other ambassadors from all the other countries that were ambassadors to the UAE, and the respect for the United States is enormous. We are the leader of the world. We are revered. We are needed. And I felt that the minute I got there, especially from the Five Eyes, which are the five English-speaking countries. I met regularly with their ambassadors. That would be Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Great Britain, and the United States. And we met twice a month for lunch and very, you know, secret kind of enclosed conditions. And you could just see how our penetration and our representation was so needed and how everybody depended on it. So that was number one, this idea that our star has fallen and we're not respected anymore around the world. I never saw one ounce of that. Quite the contrary. I was surprised as to how much everyone revered the United States of America. And then the second part was the leadership of the UAE itself and how they have desperately worked toward having a better relationship with us, trying to meet us more than halfway on them modernizing their economy, them addressing human rights, them investing this unbelievable national treasure that they have, this enormous wealth to better mankind throughout the world. So when I got there, I felt that there was this opportunity to advance this relationship even further.
We're talking to John Rakolta Jr., who's now the chairman of Walbridge. He was also involved with something called the Abraham Accords. When we come back, we're going to talk to him about that. And I'm Jack Brazil, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Krasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Brazil. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to John Rakolta Jr., who for 600 days was our ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. And during that time, you were involved with something called the Abraham Accord. And now I hear it referred to as the Abraham Accords. Which is right?
Both.
And what is it?
So the Abraham Accords, or Accord, is a declaration between countries to recognize the importance of maintaining and strengthening peace in the Middle East and around the world. And it's based upon aspirational principles. We'll get into that in a minute, but the reason why there's accord versus accords is because the first country that we approached was the UAE, and it was done in a very, very classified setting, knowing full well that peace had eluded the Middle East for 25 years. Yes, there was a Camp David Accord in 1978 and another one with Jordan in 1994, but both of those are basically referred to as cold pieces. They're good fences make good neighbors. And of course, when you have a fence, it's hard to trade. And so those accords never really reached the potential and the promise that everybody had expected. And so you enter this environment that I had just described in the last segment of a country that's wanting to move forward with modernity and knew that Israel was an important element, because after all, Israel is a country that had no natural resources, no water, no oil, very little to go by. And they've created this nation in the last 70 years that's just a marvelous democracy, and also has been deemed this startup nation, that they figured out how to have this innovation and entrepreneurship and has leaped other societies in terms of their advancement. And the Emirati saw this as, how do we develop something like that? So they were ready. They knew that oil would one day be gone, and they have no longer be able to rely on that, and wanted to transition into a knowledge-based economy. based on peace and prosperity. So you put all this stuff together and you have what I consider to be an opportunity, the understanding that peace is harder to keep for long term than war, and that we had the right people at the helm. Jared Kushner and the president set forth a policy change that really opened up the opportunity to negotiate this accord. And that was that peace no longer went through a settled agreement with the Palestinians. They found that very hard to achieve. Jared launched a Prosperity for Peace initiative that went nowhere. And so they went about it in another way, and that was to try to get a Gulf nation to normalize relationships with Israel. The UAE was picked as the most reliable, the closest one to the Americas, and the one that had begun to move toward our idea of the rights of the individuals. And so we picked one. That was them. And so the reason it was called the Abraham Peace Accord was because there was just one country. That was the UAE. It was one country between Israel and the UAE. We knew it was going to work. We knew it was needed, but we didn't realize until after it was announced on August 13th of 2019, there would be so many other countries that would want to join so quickly. Bahrain came aboard within 30 days. Sudan came aboard. Morocco eventually came aboard. And that's when it changed from just between the, Israel and the UAE to many countries. And we changed the name to the Abraham Accords.
All right. You mentioned in the previous segment, Expo 2020 Dubai, which was delayed a year because of COVID. And I believe that it's a $1 billion investment. And they wanted us, America, to come on board and spend, you know, $50, $60, $70 million to be involved. Our Congress eventually said, no way. You had to go and tell the powers to be, we can't participate. What happened when you told the principals that in Dubai?
Not having the United States there is the equivalent of not showing up for the Olympics. And the air went out of the balloon. They had been led to believe that we were coming. And when I had to tell them that we weren't, they were extraordinarily disappointed. And by the way, their investment's $10 billion, not $1 billion. And they saw this as a this expo as an opportunity to bring the world together, that they wanted to play a role in prosperity and peace. And they looked at me and they said, you know, there has to be another solution. We have to have you there as a country. This will not be a world event that the United States is missing. We both agreed to think about it for a couple more days. And one day they called me up and they said, Mr. Ambassador, we have an idea that we think you might be willing to entertain. And that is that we will gift the United States of America money to participate. And I was delighted. I was, in fact, gleeful that they had offered that. And it was now my job not only to convince Washington that this was the proper way to go, but also to ensure that we were ready to participate in November of 2020. And both of those, I was able to, with a great team of people, wonderful people within the State Department, we were able to accomplish that. And the United States is a pavilion now, is world-class. We are talking about what's important to our country, our character, our constitution, our freedoms, our opportunities. And we are a full participant in Expo 2020, which is another one of those issues that you solve that allows the country of the UAE to believe in us and that we will be there for them in their time of need.
Let me quote you now. The second industrial revolution, the electrification of the auto industry, is here. Talk about that, John.
This is an enormous leap in technology today. The amount of technology advancements, the amount of human capital, the amount of financial capital that's being directed toward this industry is of massive, massive proportion. It's going to radically change what America looks like over the next 20 or 30 years. Maybe a little slower, maybe a little faster. My company is participating in building these new electric car plants across the country. Both General Motors and Ford are unbelievable in what visions that they see. And my only concern about this is, what's Michigan's role going forward? Are we going to be able to maintain that we're the auto capital of the world? And I think that question still remains to be answered. I'm not sure that the public at large and all of our political leaders, from a local level right up to the top of the ticket, if you will, in Lansing, really understands the significance of the kind of change that's happening today and the threat that it poses to Michigan.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you tell a young listener tonight, John Ricolta?
I would, they say I'm a man of threes. And I think that the same three things that pertain to me when I was a young man pertain today. And the first is what I would call honesty, integrity, and there's nothing to replace those two aspects of a person's character. Sometimes you have to accept responsibility for what you've done rather than shifting it to somebody else. And that's hard to do sometimes, but that's number one. Number two is education. There is no substitute today for the best education that you can obtain, and it starts in preschool, learning to read and write effectively and being able to understand all of the concepts of math. So that education goes today right through at least a trade school, or at least through a four-year college degree, if not further along. And then the final thing that I think is incredibly important, that's your work ethic, that you are a warrior when it comes to the economy, and that you keep yourself healthy, both mentally, spiritually, and physically. And, you know, today's society doesn't necessarily stress those three aspects. And so, again, you know, those are the things that advice that I would give in such a short period of time. There's a lot to be said about each one of them, but those are the three highlights.
John, I'd like to thank you and Terry for your service to America and all you do for Detroit, all you do for Michigan. Please keep up the great work.
Thanks for having me today.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.